This is the Improved Photography Podcast, episode number 139. This episode is brought to you by Trigger Trap. Trigger Trap is somebody I've been using for a long time and have mentioned many times on the podcast because I love them. Trigger Trap is a powerful and intuitive free iPhone and Android app with the fastest, most reliable, and affordable hardware that plugs into your camera so that you can control a huge variety of functions on the camera. It's awesome for photographers of all skill levels. Go to TriggerTrap.com now and use discount code IMPROVE for 10% off your order. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. I'm your host, Jim Harmer, and today you are joined by thousands and thousands and thousands of photographers from all around the world, all sitting down now to get our weekly dose of photography knowledge. And to give it to you today is Nick Page and Jeff Harmon. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Well, I'm excited to be back with you. This is my very favorite part of the week. The only thing that I'm excited about more than this podcast is Boise State football this year, which starts this week for those of you in the United States. But our listener question of the week is from Tammy Sandy Odette. On the Photo Taco Facebook group asks, I'm about ready to put together a portfolio website to eventually sell my images. I was thinking about going with Smug Mug because of their commerce structure. I've been hearing a lot of wonderful things about Squarespace as well, but I'm not sure if their commerce works the same. I don't want to deal with credit cards and shipping, so that's why I was looking at Smug Mug, and she was looking for our thoughts on it. So I've done this both ways, and I've used both Squarespace and Smug Mug. So there are a lot of things to like about Smug Mug. If I were to shoot like event photography, you know, you're going to shoot little league football and you take a bunch of photos of the other kids and you want to put them on one website and just let the other moms download and have everything taken care of for you, you want Smug Mug. Smug Mug would be awesome for that. Discussed on the show last week was Pass, that a lot of the hosts are using now. I haven't actually tried yet, so I can't comment on that one. But there are some great solutions for doing event photography, and Smug Mug's among them. But there are also some things that I really didn't like about Smug Mug. I'm kind of a stickler about design. I want things to look really, really good, especially on a photography portfolio. I mean, it's aesthetics, and it's infinitely customizable, but expect to hire a developer if you're using Smug Mug and you want to do something really out of the ordinary, really creative. Most of the templates on Smug Mug, the designs that they have, and they have a lot of them, just didn't fit my needs. The pictures weren't big enough. It just felt a little bit too stockish, too clunky. And that's really the number one reason that pushed me over to Squarespace. It was a lot easier to use on Squarespace, and I love the designs. But the checkout works totally different on Squarespace. You wouldn't want to use Squarespace if you're doing that event photography kind of stuff and you want people to just download or buy the print and have it mailed to them automatically and all that kind of stuff. For me, though, Squarespace works great for that kind of thing, because if I'm doing a print, I don't sell a print if it's less than $500. I just won't do a print less than that. And so I'm not going to have a $500 print just mailed with some print developer that I don't know how it is, and I want to process it different for the print than what's going to be on my website. I'm going to want to see the print and then mail it to the customer. And so for me, that works great. I don't sell a lot of photos. I really just wait for people to email if they're interested in purchasing a photo. So it works great for me, but it really depends on your needs. I mean, there are a lot of options out there. There's not one that's, you know, the only way to go for every type of photography. I definitely recommend Squarespace for a general portfolio. It's the happiest I've ever been with it. And I started using Squarespace before they were an advertiser, because I really do like it. To each his own. Some people are going to like Smug Mug better, and that's just fine. Do whatever works for you. Mm-hmm. What comments do you guys have on that?
I think Smug Mug, Zenfolio, they both have the same limitations. So you can't customize your look as much as you would like. At least that's what I found with Zenfolio. But where they are much more handy than Squarespace is if you're selling small prints or digital files, it's amazing how passive that can be. Essentially, they click on stuff, they order stuff, and at the end of the month, you have money in your wallet, which is nice. With Squarespace, you, like Jim said, you have to fulfill it yourself. So it totally depends on the number of photos you're going to be selling and the size of the photos. Jeff, are you happy with how you can customize stuff in Zenfolio, or are you experiencing what I experience where it's like tough to get the look that you want?
Yeah, so here's how I'd compare them. SmugMug allows you to, if you know how, go in and customize it. Like Jim had said, if you know HTML, CSS, and can go build your own web pages, then SmugMug allows you to do that for all except for the order page. And then that was branded SmugMug. You can't do a thing about it. So if someone actually orders, you get this huge thing in the upper left corner that says SmugMug on it. But you can customize it if you know how, just most people don't, at least not most photographers. Zenfolio.
Well, that's the whole purpose in getting somebody to do it is you don't want to dive into the code, and they make you dive into the code. I hate that.
And then SmugMug also takes 15% of sales, so you have to consider that. Then there's
that's probably worth it, right? I mean, if you're just doing events, it's probably
Zenfolio. On the other hand, you just get to pick between templates. You can't customize any of the look and feel besides your blog part. SmugMug doesn't even offer a blog section, so there is that service difference. It doesn't sound like the questioner here cares about that. Zenfolio takes only 10%, not 15. And I personally like the Zenfolio client interaction. I can put up on Zenfolio the proofs from a shoot and have the customer pick the ones that are their favorites. And then I'll go focus on their favorites from there. I haven't seen the others really support that very well. So I like that. And then there's Squarespace is more of the very, very beautiful design stuff, but it's not quite as supportive on the sales. The one other difference then between SmugMug and Zenfolio, SmugMug, you can only offer auto-fulfillment stuff. Zenfolio, you can offer any kind of digital product or self-fulfillment stuff alongside auto-fulfillment.
Very interesting. So there you go. There are a lot of options out there, but hopefully that'll point you in the right direction. Well, a lot of listeners of the podcast have been asking me about mirrorless cameras since I've been gushing about my Fuji X-T1 for the last while. And the gushing doesn't stop. It's just a love affair that doesn't end. This camera gets better and better. And so I've written a post on Improved Photography called The Best Mirrorless Cameras Under $1,000, which I think is a pretty popular price point for listeners of Improved Photography. And, you know, there are certainly pros and cons to all of them. If I were to pick a mirrorless camera under $1,000, it would be the Fuji X-T10. That's the little sister, maybe little brother. I'm not quite sure its gender. The Fuji X-T10 is the little sibling, anyway, of the Fuji X-T1, which is the one that I shoot. Now, the Fuji X-T1 is, you know, running around $1,100. But the Fuji X-T10 is only $800. And it's like 90-95% as good for $400 less. So, you know, save that money and buy a nice lens. There's not a lot of difference between the Fuji X-T1 and the X-T10, but it's a really beautiful camera at a nice viewpoint, at a nice price point. Another option is the Sony A6000. Darren Meller bought one and he didn't love it because the autofocus is just too slow. The Fuji X-T10 and X-T1 do much better with autofocus than the A6000 if we're talking about the new firmware on the X-T1 and the X-T10 as well. But the A6000 is a really compelling camera because of that price. I mean, it is so inexpensive and it's a very capable camera. If you forget about the autofocus, I mean, you can. It's $550 brand new, and you pick them up for $450 used. I mean, that is a steal for a very nice camera. Another one, last one to consider is the Olympus OMD EM5. Now, this is a Micro Four Thirds camera, so the aspect ratio is chopped on the edges, where you're used to the 3x2 aspect ratio on most cameras, where it's a little bit wider. The 4/3 is, you know, well, it's 4/3, you know, it's not quite square, but kind of getting close to square. So you kind of have to get used to that aspect ratio, which is one tough thing for me. It's also a significantly smaller sensor than a crop sensor, which is what the A6000 and the Fuji X-T10 both are. So with a smaller sensor, well, we know some of the limitations that that comes with, but there is a huge, inexpensive, and very high quality lens system for Micro Four Thirds, and they're a lot lighter weight as well. So I would consider those as maybe the top three to choose from, but check out the post, just the 10 best mirrorless cameras under $1,000. If you just Google it, it'll probably come up. So definitely a lot to consider, and this field is, I mean, really heating up with some competition. Have you guys looked at mirrorless? Both of you are shooting DSLRs. What's keeping you back?
My investment mostly.
Same with me. Yeah.
I have so much money invested in lenses that it would be really hard to switch over to anything else.
No, you'd pocket a ton of money.
Yeah, eventually.
You totally would.
Eventually, but I shoot things that you just can't shoot on those little cameras.
Like sports.
And
sports is the one that I'd say, nope, not happening. Right. Anything else, I say, absolutely.
And like birds in flight.
Those
two things.
Not gonna happen.
But the camera that has had me so excited are all these new cameras coming from Sony. The A7S, I've seen some examples of some astrophotography done with those cameras, and the noise performance is like crazy, crazy good. It just leaves everything in the dust. It's amazing what they're doing with that particular camera. So there's a big part of me that wants to have a Sony camera in the bag too, but that is so like financially irresponsible that I can't ever make myself actually do that. And I don't think I could even afford to do that, but it would be so cool to have some Sony stuff in the bag because their noise performance is just amazing. And for landscape photography and astrophotography, I think that those are the cameras that would get me really excited.
Jeff, how about you?
Well, So I'm so happy with the camera I've got and feel like it's, for me, I'm shooting all types of photography. I'm trying to capture my kids doing things at school, in sports. Sometimes I'm out on the soccer field with lots of light. Sometimes I'm in a gymnasium where there's no light. Sometimes I want something far away. I'm doing landscapes. I'm dabbling in all sorts of it. And I feel like my 70 Mark II is one that rises to the occasion, not probably as good as other cameras could in some areas. It falls short, but it's good enough for what I want to do right now. And it meets, it's kind of like the jack of all trades, master of none sort of camera. And I feel like it's really meeting that need well. It is really appealing for the Fuji, though. I do have to say, you're really kind of wearing on me.
My gosh, has gushed onto you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's good.
I'd like to try it out, I think, but I'm just happy with what I have.
I think very quickly it's going to be tough to justify the Canon and Nikon stuff, but not now, not at all. Like the fact that both of you are shooting DSLRs and I was until a couple months ago. Right now I feel like it's really on the fence. For some people, the mirrorless is going to outweigh the drawbacks, and for some people, it's going to be the DSLR. I don't think that's going to be the case at all 2 years from now. I think 2 years from now, that's going to be tough to justify the dinosaur, especially at the pace at which Canon and Nikon are moving. It is a snail's pace compared to what the mirrorless cameras are doing. I mean, the flagship camera, the Canon 5D Mark III that everybody owns and loves, right? It's already 3.5 years old. And there's not an update in the imminent future, at least. It's going to be 4 years old before that camera is updated. In camera years, that's old. That's old. Can you imagine if Apple only released an iPhone every 4 years? It's just crazy. I mean, just totally crazy because technology changes a lot in that much time.
I follow Canon rumors pretty closely because I've got a 5D Mark III and I want to know as soon as the 5D Mark IV is coming out, because as soon as it comes out, my 5D Mark III is going to be like instantly worth $1,000 less.
Yeah.
And it's going to lose so much of its value. So I'm going to try to ditch mine and then go a couple months without, with just my backup camera, and then pick up the 5D Mark IV when it comes out.
That's
because,
smart.
Because I'm hoping, in quotation marks, that it's going to be better, but there's no guarantee that it's going to be, you know, this huge upgrade. So it's a little bit discouraging, because they were promising us a 5D Mark IV in like the first quarter of this year. Uh-huh. And then it got moved to late summer, and then it got moved to fall, and now it's looking like 2016. And it's like, oh, dude, it's so annoying. I'm going to be, you know, and I'm happy with my 5D Mark III, but the grass is always greener. Like, we always want something a little bit better than what we got. And I look at my star shots that are shot at like 6400 ISO, and I'm like, you know, I wish that was completely noiseless. And so, you know, I'm eagerly awaiting that 5D Mark IV that might come out sometime before I'm 50 years old.
Well, and you know, the Canon 5D Mark III is an excellent camera. Like, excellent. All the stuff that Canon and Nikon make are still really good stuff. But it's the pace that I'm really concerned with, because there's no way they can keep up at that slow of a pace. I mean, they're just getting outpaced. Are they beaten right now? For some photographers, yes. For some, no. But the pace would tell me that absolutely they're going to get beaten before long. So I'm interested to see what happens there. I think in the next 2 years, there are going to be a lot of photographers switching camera systems, you know, maybe in staying with Canon and Nikon and maybe ditching, but interesting to see.
Right. And it used to be that all the video shooters out there were shooting with like Canon 5D Mark III or 60 or something like that. But they've all completely bailed on Canon, you know, they're all Panasonic, you know, those GH4s, they came out with 4K, and there's the Sony has amazing 4K, the new Sony A7 R2, what is it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, A7R2.
And it's got 4K, plus it's got better noise performance. Like, you know, as far as video, they've totally been left in the dust, and that's a large part of their market too. So,
and mirrorless just makes a lot of sense for video, because you're recording video, and so you want to see live the video, not what your optical viewfinder sees. And so you want to see all those overlays that it can put on the image. When you're shooting a DSLR for video, you don't get to see quite as much all that stuff that we get to see on the mirrorless camera, unless we're shooting on the LCD. Then it's away from the body, and you got to get a big rig and stuff to hold it steady. Mirrorless makes a lot of sense for video. All right. Well, in our main segment, we want to ditch the gear talk that we love and talk a little bit more about the photography-centric stuff, and that is shooting fall color. For those of you in the Southern Hemisphere, we apologize. I realize that it is not fall for you. It's more of spring. But for those of us in the Northern Hemisphere, it is heating up. It is time for landscape photographers to get out and shoot. And if you don't plan ahead with fall color, you miss it. I mean, you really have to spend some time on websites, on Pixoto, on 500px, looking at photos in the area you want to photograph to see the dates that they were taken, so that you know when to plan to shoot, when to get to the location that you're going to shoot at. I had the kind of unfortunate experience, I think it was 2 years ago, of going to West Virginia with many of the readers of Improved Photography. We're there on our free photography workshop series, and we shot the fall color there. We were a little bit too late. Now, I got some awesome photos. Some of my very highest rated photos were taken on that trip, so I don't regret it one bit, and we loved the trip. It was so fun, but oh, I wish we were there a couple days earlier. So it's something you really have to plan ahead for. Jeff, what are some things you've been looking at with fall color?
Well, so it's just been killing me lately, because the Mother Nature's been putting on some major shows here in the Salt Lake area for the last week. The sunsets, sunrises have just been awesome. The clouds near the mountains have made the sunrises and sunsets look beautiful. And I'm trapped behind the wheel of a car taking kids to school or picking them up from soccer practice, things like that. So I've been taking my iPhone and trying to capture it with the power lines and the signs and everything in the way. And just like, oh, I wish I could be somewhere else right now to take this. It's so just killing me. But as I've gone back and looked through my catalog, it's these few months of the fall where I've had the best stuff. Mm-hmm. So I've had some stuff I like out of the summer pictures, the summer photos. You can have a certain feel and effect on it, but they're usually very bright yellow, summer kinds of pictures. And my own preference is just the fall scene. I really love the colors. The colors in the sunrise and sunset just seem to be a lot deeper in the fall to me than they do in the summer. And I just really love it. So I wanted to talk today about kind of how to make sure you get some opportunities to make the most of that. What kind of gear or techniques we'd all recommend for people to follow so they can have the best chance of capturing those shows that Mother Nature's putting on.
Yeah, Nick, what are some things that you do?
The biggest thing, we've kind of talked off air about this, is just carving out time in your calendar to actually do it. That's one of the things that I'm struggling really hard with right now, is carving out time of any sort. This year I'm going to get to shoot like 2 days of fall color on a weekend. Like, I'm going to have a 2-day road trip, and that's just not enough. That's not enough for me, because I don't know for a fact that that's going to be like optimum color, and I'm going to have to do some research finding out like, okay, during this weekend, where is going to have awesome fall color. So carving out time is kind of a big one, because if you don't carve out the time, you're not going to get anything. Secondly, keep an eye on the weather, because like you said, Jeff, the weather does some really cool, interesting things this time of year. We start getting some low clouds and some fog and all those things that you don't get in the summer months. Instead of it being in the middle of the winter where it's like fog on white, it's like barren and ugly looking, you get a little bit of fog with some fall color leaves in the background. It just makes for super beautiful photography. So trying to stay on top of the weather. And if you see, a few hours ahead of time that, it's going to do something interesting tonight, maybe the kids can find a different ride to practice. I don't know. Like, maybe it's time for a babysitter. Daddy needs some alone time. But, just keep an eye on the weather, because it can change fairly rapidly this time of year. And there's just opportunities this time of year that you don't get during the other season. So those would be some of my recommendations.
Other thing I think is really cool about it is, this is finally a time where you don't have to have some horrid extreme to try to get those sunrise and sunsets. It's like a normal time of waking up and a normal time of getting ready for bed or whatever, or dinner. So you don't have to be waking up at horrid hours to go capture this stuff. Mm-hmm. But that also means it collides with life. That's what makes it hard.
Yeah, it's true. But I was making the schedule for the Utah and Arizona free workshop that we're doing, and I was looking at the time sunrise and sunset is, and I was like, oh, this is going to be like a vacation. This is great. When the sunset's like 9 o'clock in the morning, this is perfect.
Yeah. Those 4:30 sunsets are a lot easier to shoot than the, 9:30 ones in the middle of the summer or whatever.
What gear, Nick? Okay. How would you, if you've got, let's say it's a weekend, so we know we can maybe not have life impacted as much. What gear are you going to take with you to try to get the best shots out of this, and how would you use the gear?
As opposed to like a lot of the summertime shots that I do, or like when I go to the ocean, a lot of times I'm shooting super wide angle in those situations. But with fall color, it almost feels like a more appropriate time to start using some of those longer focal lengths, because you're trying to fill the entire frame with all that color. And if you go super wide, you're going to end up with like, a little streak of colored trees on the bottom of my giant sky photo. Shooting with longer focal lengths, I think, is a good idea this time of year. Just give it a try. A lot of my favorite fall color photos are done with a telephoto lens. Also, I'm going to see if I can get Jim on board with this. Polarizing filters, right?
Oh, I was going to suggest that.
Awesome. Okay. So totally agree.
We agree.
Because this is the one time of year where you really want to minimize glare and bring out all the saturation on all those leaves. So a polarizing filter is perfect for that. So
yeah, absolutely. It's the foliage that's cool, right? Like, mm-hmm. without the leaves, it's just a dead tree. Right. So so if you get glare on those leaves, which happens a lot, I mean, it's kind of a rainier season when, you know, if they're wet, there's dew on the leaves, something like that, you're going to get a lot of glare. And that glare, guess what it does? Cuts the saturation. And that's the opposite of what you want. You want it to really show those colors. So polarizer is an awesome, awesome one. We agree on something. Another one that that I know we agree on is the HSL panel. Like, if I only had two things in photography, it would be my Fuji X-T1 and the HSL panel in Lightroom. That's all I need. Because with fall color, you know, it's color. That's the thing. And so the hue, saturation, and luminance panel in Lightroom on the right side is gold for this. You know, you get a leaf that's just kind of that orangish dead. Well, you can just click it and drag to the right, and suddenly it becomes a vibrant red. I had several presets in the Lightroom Steel from last year where I did this, and it was very popular. I saw a ton of fall photos that were just incredible transformations by using that hue, saturation, luminance panel. You know, even if things look pretty good, you got great color in camera, go in there, because I'll bet you can tweak it and make it look even better.
Awesome. Yeah, and I have one more, and this is kind of a super advanced technique that I'm just going to hint at, and people can research it. But it's actually dodging and burning with color. And this is something you would do in Photoshop, where you create a new layer, you change the blend mode to overlay, and then essentially you sample a color and you paint over areas, and you use it like a dodge and burn technique, only you're adding a little bit of saturation of whatever particular color you're painting with. I won't go into depth with it because it's a pretty advanced technique, but it's something for everybody to kind of Google and check out. So that's another tip that I got.
Very cool.
One other suggestion I was going to provide, and it's probably not exclusive to fall, and maybe it's on my mind because people have kind of asked me lately if I have anything vertical, meaning portrait, not landscape, for sale. I guess people have spaces. I've had some that have like dental offices where they have a vertical space in between their different bays that they have the chairs in for people to go sit in. And they'd like to put something there, but the landscape stuff doesn't fit. They want something that's portrait orientation. So trying to take a picture of the fall colors, I'm thinking of like rivers or streams that you go to where there's trees on both sides that have turned the colors, and getting a portrait orientation shot of that is something that's really pretty. Mm-hmm.
That's just a great tip in general, because it's a good idea to go ahead and get a landscape oriented photo and then a portrait oriented photo.
Right.
If you have an awesome photo, maybe you can get it on a cover of a magazine, and you know that you need a vertical shot for that. So that's a great tip in general.
Yeah.
How about HDR? Do you use that when you're shooting the fall colors?
Not really, because a lot of times if there is some kind of sky or fog in the shot, I kind of want that to go away and get blown out. I'm not trying to suck any detail out of fog usually, so I generally don't do too much HDR when it comes to fall color shots.
I think it can look really cool, but I don't know, I it's so rare that I use HDR anymore. I just feel like now with Lightroom, especially since they made the switch to the highlight slider instead of what did it used to be? The
recovery.
Yeah. Once they made that switch, I can pull so much out of the raw file now that I just don't feel like I need it very often. Mm-hmm. But it does have that look that sometimes can be really cool. So, you know, I wouldn't write it off for sure, but honestly, in reality, about once every 6 months, I'll say, oh yeah, I should do that Photomatix thing again. And every time I do, I'm happy with it. Like, I love Photomatix, but I just don't do it very often. I need to remember to do it a little bit more. Well, that's a little bit about fall color. I'm excited to get out there and shoot a little bit. But before we go on, we want to thank two people that have made the Improved Photography Podcast possible. And one that I am really excited about is Trigger Trap. I've been using Trigger Trap for a long time. It's like the best kept secret in photography. It's a very inexpensive little piece of technology that plugs. You have one little dongle that plugs into the little port on your phone, the headphone jack on your phone. Then the other one plugs into your camera. And they make them for, I mean, all kinds of different camera brands, just about every connection you could want. They make it for my Fuji, Canon, Nikon. Check on their website. Lots are supported. So once you have those two, like you think about your smartphone, it's an expensive device with all kinds of sensors. I mean, it has light sensors, it has sound, it has motion, it has the accelerometer, it has orientation of the way the phone's turned, all kinds of sensors in your phone. And it uses that technology to make your camera, to give it a huge upgrade to your camera. So I'm going to pull up Trigger Trap's mobile app, which actually looks nice and is easy to use. And on there, it just has a huge list of things that you can add to your camera that you don't get otherwise. So you can use it as just a regular cable release, which, you know, will save you money in buying a cable release and having an extra thing around. You can also press and hold as if it's bulb mode. You can press and lock it so it keeps taking a picture for as long as it's locked. You can do a timed release, so you can say, hey, take a picture for 4 minutes for night photography. You can do a self timer. You can do time lapse. You can do advanced time lapse with bulb ramping. You can do time warp, distance lapse, star trail, ramping, sound sensor, vibration sensor, motion sensor. I mean, just it's incredible how many different things you do. I'm only halfway down the list. You got an Apple Watch or a Pebble Watch and you want that integrated? It's already built in. It's incredible what's in Trigger Trap, and it's really pretty inexpensive. I mean, go check. Do yourself a favor. Go to TriggerTrap.com. And in fact, you can use discount code IMPROVE, and that'll give you another 10% off. But the reason I want you to go to buy it from TriggerTrap.com, or at least go there first, is because they have a thing that you can enter what your camera model is, and it'll tell you which model of Trigger Trap you need, so it's compatible with your exact camera. And then they have links to buy it on Amazon or on other stores. So go to TriggerTrap.com and use discount code IMPROVE, and you get 10% off. I've been using them for a long time, even before they were advertising on the podcast, and I love them. So check it out at TriggerTrap.com and use offer code IMPROVE. And by Animoto. Animoto is the best way to make a slideshow for your photography, adding a little bit of motion to your photography. Before the days that I was using Animoto, I fell into the horrible and embarrassing experience of trying other software that's much more confusing. And when I was doing a slideshow for a church group, I had everything set, had tons of photos ready to go. It took a little bit longer than I thought, and I had that horrible moment where you're standing in front of a group of 100 people trying to make a slideshow, and the technology isn't working, and it won't play on the projector, and it started halfway into the slideshow, and the music wasn't lined up. It was a disaster. So embarrassing when you get a group together and the technology does not work for you. And Animoto can totally fix that for you. So go to Animoto.com/improve and use promo code IMPROVE, and that'll get you 15% off an annual pro subscription to Animoto. That's Animoto.com. Animoto makes the best slideshows in the industry. Drag and drop video builder. You can mix photos and video clips. They are awesome. Well, in the next portion of the show, we want to get to our round robin 5 minute segments. And Jeff, I'm going to toss this over to you first with an update on Windows Dez. That was a little Portuguese for you.
I got it. Yeah. All right. So Windows 10, just can you have continued updates here until the recommendation is to go? And it's not yet. The recommendation I have is still to wait.
Hold the lines.
Yeah. I wouldn't, if I were a professional photographer relying on a Windows PC to do my photo editing, I would stay where I'm at for the time being. And here's why. There's a few issues that are still kind of out there right now with Windows 10. it has to do with the first one is problems. People have had problems opening up their Lightroom catalog after the upgrade. So they do the upgrade, everything seems great, then they hit the Lightroom icon to launch the program, and it says, I can't open your library or your catalog. Yeah,
that is
scary. And even if they go to open up a backup, depending on where the library backs up to, those are also not able to be opened.
What? Why? What's causing that?
So it's a permissions problem. It doesn't happen for everybody, but for some people, when they upgrade, their user directory gets set with some screwy permissions and Lightroom can't read it as the user. So there's a way to get around it. There's a workaround. I've documented it at improvephotography.com. You can go search for two key issues with Windows 10. And I have instructions in there, or a link to the instructions on what you can do if you run into that problem, how to fix it. But for right now, I think it's something that it happens rarely, but enough that I think Microsoft will be addressing it and making sure it doesn't happen. And it'd be a whole lot easier just to not have to deal with it. Another huge problem has been AMD graphics cards. Now, in general, I've recommended that you don't do AMD graphics cards if you want to do digital video or photography. I don't know why the vendors have chosen, but they have kind of anointed NVIDIA as the preferred, most supported line of graphics cards. It doesn't make a lot of sense because AMD has some very great graphics cards. Gaming does great with them. But especially the Adobe products, the support is not nearly as good in AMD as it is for the NVIDIA cards. But if you have an AMD card, people have really just found that as they've upgraded Windows 10, not just for running Lightroom and Photoshop, they've had lots of trouble with AMD graphics cards in Windows 10 in general. And just this last Monday on 8/31, AMD released a beta version of their drivers, the Catalyst version 15.8, that people have been reporting fixes this problem for them. Makes Windows 10 run better and makes it so that Lightroom and Photoshop run. It got so bad for some people when they were running Windows 10 and AMD graphics cards, they couldn't even open Lightroom. It would crash as it started up. And that's because the graphics acceleration was turned on by default. And it was so poor, the AMD graphics card, that it couldn't start. So that's been a pretty negative experience. It's not a full production driver yet. It's only a beta. If you're AMD graphics, you for sure should wait. That's not currently what you should do. I've also seen lots of reports of Wacom devices. Is that how you pronounce it? Wacom?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. they're the tablets that you can use like a pen to do your work in Photoshop. I personally haven't used one, but I know lots do. And they haven't released any drivers for Windows 10. And I'm seeing lots of reports of issues with it that they're not working correctly. So if you use Wacom, don't upgrade to Windows 10 yet. Another issue is QuickTime. The latest version of QuickTime cannot install or run under Windows 10.
And QuickTime's made by Apple, and you know how excited they are to fix that for the Windows platform.
Right.
They're going to do that right away.
And some might be wondering, well, wait, I'm not running a Mac. Why do I care about QuickTime? Adobe leverages QuickTime for exporting movies out of Lightroom or Photoshop.
That's true.
So you still have to have it if you're running a PC. There is a workaround. Some people are saying that if they install and run version 7.6 instead of the most current version, that works and they can make it work, make it go. But it's just another thing that it'll get worked out. Eventually something will be released, so it'll work. The user base of Windows 10 has already grown to a really significant portion of the world. So they can't ignore it and it'll get fixed. So those are a few of the issues I've been seeing. I'm trolling all of the forums out there on behalf of all the photographers. I'm doing all the geek work so that everyone can have an update on when they should go to Windows 10. It's not yet. There's just too many issues. I'm expecting there's going to be a few more uncovered. So stay tuned to the podcast here and to the website. I will make sure when it is time and when I feel like it's calmed down enough to recommend when it's time to go. And when it is, I will have numbers. I've already taken the metrics before converting on resource utilization and speed, performance kinds of things. After I do it, I'll retake those metrics and I'll be able to give you an apples to apples comparison on how the performance and resource utilization changed with Windows 10.
So that's very cool. And thank you for doing that, because I know there are a ton, thousands and thousands of Windows 10 users or Windows users on the podcast who listen to the show. And Windows 10 is a free upgrade for almost everybody. And so this is going to impact a lot of the listeners of the show. Well, in my 5-minute segment, I want to talk about a recent photo trip I took to Alaska. Name that movie. Anybody? No?
Nothing.
It's the proposal with Sandra Bullock. Sorry. Yeah,
no.
Sheesh. Anyway, I went to Alaska, and it was in the Juneau area down in Gustavus. And so we got on a tiny little prop plane, and I did a time-lapse video out the plane window the entire way. And about halfway through it, I started to notice a weird black line running horizontally along the video that would, you know, scan down to the bottom and then start at the top and scan down. And so I wondered what that is, and everybody's phones seemed to show the same thing. And I think what it is just the vibrations of the plane were just right that it messed up the frame rate of the video, that it was bouncing at just the right time. So for a portion of the video, it messed it up. So I actually take pictures out of plane windows pretty often. So something to at least consider as you're doing that. I wish I would have just done a long video and then sped it up afterward, because it was only a 20-minute flight. But I did a time lapse, and so it was just a still picture, and so it kind of messed it up. But one interesting thing that happened to me is I've been interested to see how the Fuji X-T1 would fare in regards to the toughness test. You all know that I have destroyed more than my fair share of cameras, but I do find that you can sell them for parts on eBay for a lot more than you'd expect. I put my Nikon D810 up on eBay, and it's completely broken. I've taken it to two different camera repair places and sent it into Nikon, and everybody said, nah, it's gone. And I put it up on eBay. It sold literally within 30 seconds for $700. Completely wow. Useless camera. But I guess, you know, those people obviously must know how to Frankenstein together those cameras and are going to turn that into a brand new camera. Anyway, so I was interested to see how the Fuji X-T1 would do in a toughness test, but I didn't really want to push the envelope because of my trash track record. Well, we were out on a little tiny boat out in the ocean, and on the way back, a storm came. I mean, crazy storm, like Armageddon storm, right on the ocean, and we didn't realize it was coming. Our captain didn't realize it was coming. And we were an hour away from the dock, and so I mean, we had to shut the back door on this little cabin, and everybody was holding on for dear life. We were just, I mean, it was just, we'd go, the boat would catch air and boom, boom. It would just slam between the waves. It was crazy. You couldn't even see out the windows because it was just water everywhere. And I forgot my Fuji X-T1 in an underwater housing, bouncing around in the back of the boat. It's just bouncing around for an hour this crazy storm. It was so bad that I was sitting on a little table there, and when we would hit, my head hit the top of the cabin a few times because we were bouncing around so bad. And like I was holding on for dear life. And I realized once we got back to the dock, I looked in the back of the boat, and there it is, the Fuji X-T1 in my underwater housing, just bouncing around in the boat. I was surprised it stayed in the boat, didn't bounce out. And so I thought, oh no, I've done it again. How did I do this? But I was afraid for my life, people. And so I looked at it. The camera is completely unscathed. I mean, not a scratch, not a ding, not a nothing. It looks perfect. It works perfect. And it was in the underwater housing. But I mean, it was bouncing around pretty good. And I shot with it in the pouring rain without the underwater housing. No problems whatsoever. Not recommended. I don't know how I did it. How I forgot my dear camera. It's like, can a suckling mother forget her child? What does it say in the Bible? But I forgot it. But Fuji X-T1 passes the toughness test, I guess, is the moral of this story. The underwater housing was awesome. We shot in some of the rivers there, and the water looked like crystal clear, but with the underwater housing, I'd put it under and you take pictures and you just see so much sediment and backscatter and just stuff in the water. So I guess my tip there is, if you're doing kind of underwater photos, it's got to be perfectly clear water or else it just looks nasty. So a couple things that I learned in Alaska this week. Nick, what do you got for us?
I don't have anything quite as dramatic as that. I don't know how I'm supposed to follow the perfect storm story. So I was going to talk a little bit about renting camera gear. Yeah, super exciting. With football season coming up, I have a couple opportunities to shoot some college games, and I've mentioned in the past how I like to use a particular lens, namely the Sigma 120 to 300 f/2.8 when I shoot football. It's an awesome lens for the extra reach, for the price, really awesome for football. And so anytime I'm going to be doing something that I don't do very often and I need a special lens for that, I like to rent lenses. So lenses like the Sigma 120 to 300 or the Sigma 150 to 600, those are lenses that I like to rent. And I know that I've gotten some questions as to places where I recommend people rent. And so I've used borrowlenses.com quite a bit. And have you guys used Borrow Lenses before?
Yeah, lots of times.
Yeah. And it's good. I like it a lot. You have to kind of schedule stuff way in advance. They're such a popular company that things are not always readily available.
I haven't had problems with that. I've always had stuff in stock that I've looked for.
Normally, it's like the latest and the greatest stuff that they don't have. Like if a lens comes out and when they first get their hands on a few copies of it, it's rented for several months. So it's really hard to get that newest lens out. So another resource that I've been using is BrentRentsLenses.com, and he only rents Canon gear. So that's kind of a downside. But if you're a Canon shooter, it's a great website to rent through. I know that I'm going to be renting the new Sigma, what is it, the 24-35 f/2. Have you guys tried that lens yet?
I haven't.
It's a new art lens from Sigma. I have that reserved, and I'm going to be trying it out and testing it out and stuff, and I'm going to be getting that from there as well. So anytime that you're going to be using a lens that is not something that you use very often, I don't recommend buying those specialty lenses that you use once a month or once every 3 months. Rent them. And so that's what I do. That's what I wanted to talk about, and it's not as good a story.
Now I've talked about it.
Yes, and nobody died in the making of my 5-minute segment, and I didn't go through any epic storms like Jim.
Well, I'm glad you didn't. Well, this week was a big week for me, and I would assume that everybody listening to the podcast has already heard about it because I sent out an email on the email newsletter. We posted in the Improved Photography Podcast listeners Facebook group on the Improved Photography Facebook page. It's been kind of everywhere, so I would assume almost everybody has seen it, but improvephotography.com/start. So I've been working on this project for months. It is the new beginning photography class, and I'm calling it Photography Start because the feedback that I got all the time with the beginning class is, you know, I thought I wasn't going to learn very much in the class. I thought it would be a little bit too basic for me, but whoa, I picked up a lot of different things. And so I decided to call this Photography Start and just get rid of that beginner word. But this is a class, I'll tell you who it's for. If you can't shoot in manual mode confidently, then this is the class for you. If you feel like you struggle to get good lighting on your photos, especially composition, I've been talking about block method composition a little bit on the podcast, but it's such a visual thing that I don't feel like I can explain without a video. And so I include my block method composition presentation in that class. The photos I took in the kitchen that I mentioned on the podcast, just putting myself in the kitchen for a couple hours and seeing what I could do with the basic DSLR, that video's in there. When I went to Italy this spring, I filmed all kinds of tutorials there to show about lighting and landscapes. There is a ton of stuff in there, 22 videos in full HD. You get to download them or stream them to any device and keep them forever. I mean, I just, nobody does that. Nobody does that. When they make online video, they're very careful to protect it. And I just want everybody to be able to see it. You know, some people might steal it, you know, whatever. Some people are always going to do that. But I want the people who purchase it to be able to really use that video in whatever way is most convenient for them. So very easy to access the video. Check it out at improvephotography.com/start. I've been getting really great feedback. It's been really overwhelming this week how many people I've heard from, which has been awesome. And I made a coupon code for you to get $40 off the class, and that is podcast. So that's improvephotography.com/start, and the coupon code is podcast. That'll give you $40 off. Now, it's only $90 to start with, so you can do the math. This is a pretty good deal of what you're getting at improvephotography.com/start. I also include an ebook in there, and I have a couple other ideas of things that I'm going to add to it that anybody who purchases will also get at later on. So check that out, improvephotography.com/start. Well, let's get into the doodads of the week. Jeff, what do you have for us?
Lightroom Collections, which has been, it's been my pick in the past too, but I couldn't join the podcast last week. And as I was listening to it, I was just screaming at it. Oh,
I had Ryan to scream several times at the podcast. I got thrown under the bus last week when I wasn't here.
Yep. I was listening to it, and we had, I forget the exact question now, but someone was asking about how you use Lightroom to manage your photos, how to organize them. And they went through Nick and Darren and Brian one by one saying, do you use collections? Nope. Do you use collections? Nope. Nobody used collections.
I use collections, but I don't use smart collections. My collections are dumb. So, yeah.
All right. Well, the bottom line is collections, I think, are so powerful in Lightroom, and I can see how Adobe is trying to lead us down that's the preferred method for organizing them, because that is how you get stuff synced to mobile. So Lightroom Mobile, the way you get your library stuff synced out to Lightroom Mobile to like your iPad is through collections. That's how you get them out there. And it's powerful enough that you could literally dump every photo you take into a single directory. And as long as you, while you import, put them into collections well, then you totally would have everything organized. It wouldn't matter where they are on your hard drive. You wouldn't have to worry about, do I have year folders and then month folders and then event folders or any of that kind of stuff if you use collections. And one of the huge advantages is a photo may qualify to be in multiple collections. And all it takes, it just has a pointer to it. You have one copy on your hard drive in one spot. And then you have your landscape collection, or maybe your vacation collection, or your family collection, or whatever kinds of ways you want to organize your photos in the collections. You can have that one shot in all of them, wherever they apply, wherever it makes sense to have them. One of the things that I've been saying a lot on the podcast over the last year or so had been trying to improve year over year by selecting your top 10 and organizing that so that you can build your portfolio and update your portfolio every year, making sure your best work gets out there and replaces stuff that maybe you're not quite as proud of anymore. You've gotten better and improved. That's the whole idea of this, would be to improve. And you can pick your best stuff from this year and go replace it in your portfolio for next year. And collections is the way that I'm doing that through the year as I'm going through and I'm doing my edits. And I think, wow, this one's really pretty good. I think this one might end up being in the running for top 10. I'll drag it over to the top 10 collection, I call it the potential top 10, I think is the name I named of the collection. Now at the end of the year, when it's time for me to go do that, I'll have all the candidates together. I'm not going to have to go through thousands and thousands of photos to try to say which ones I think should be possibilities for the top 10. I'll have it narrowed down to probably 50, and then it's easier to go and organize them. And there's other things, that all the event stuff, finding things in the collections is much easier than trying to search through your folders on your hard drive, even through Lightroom, searching through the folders on the hard drive. It's just so much harder to go try to find things. The smart collections can help you organize them with, you can find all the shots that you tagged with certain things or that you took at certain exposures or any kind of setting that you have around the photos as you created the collection. You can have be kind of a parameter to have the smart collections built. I do not leverage that quite as much. So Nick, I'm with you that I don't really use the smart collections all that much, but I do definitely use collections as a way to organize my photos and recommend anyone to do that.
I use smart collections a ton. I don't use regular collections very often.
All right.
So,
Nick, what do you have for us?
Well, first of all, I would like to penalize Jeff for having too long of a doodad. He gets how many 5 minute segments does Jeff get this episode? Okay, so mine is going to be an application, and it's called Stellarium, and it's both for desktop and mobile, and it's an awesome application for planning your night sky photo shoots. And what this does is you can pick a night, any night in the future, and you can play in real time or sped up exactly how the Earth is going to rotate and when the stars become visible over the horizon, and you can really plan your shoots this way. It's awesome because you get to choose exactly. That was tripping me out, man. I was like, is that a recording glitch? Okay. So anyways, it's awesome. It's good. You should check it out. And
he just gave up.
Well, and you see how brief I am.
The week is the Fuji MCEX 11 extension tubes. Just go get extension tubes for whatever camera you have. I have recommendations if you go to improvephotography.com/macro lens for DSLR folks, some that I found that were very inexpensive. But get some extension tubes. They're very inexpensive and really open up a lot of different possibilities for shooting macro photos with the lenses you already own. Well, that does it for this week of the Improved Photography Podcast. We will continue the bickering after the podcast episode ends. Until then, we will see you in 7 days after the Boise State Broncos kick butt of Washington Huskies.